An important offshoot of the Me Too movement was the exhortation to believe women when they make sexual assault accusations. But what exactly does believe women demand? And can that demand be justified? Should we all believe in guilt on the strength of an accusation alone, no matter what? Or do the context and the consequences of the belief matter? Some people have wondered how the demand to believe coheres with the presumption of innocence. But is it true that we should employ the same presumption of innocence and standards of proof in everyday life as we do in law? How should the hearer of a she said, he said type accusation reason about its likely truth? I'm Kate Greasley, an Associate Professor of Law at the University of Oxford, where I teach and research on the law of sexual offences and the philosophy of consent. In Oxford Conversations on Consent, I speak to scholars of law and philosophy about the ethics of consent, sexual wrongdoing, and the wider themes of the Me Too movement. Georgie Gardiner is an Associate Professor of Philosophy at Tulane University, Louisiana, where she works on the philosophy of truth and evidence, among other things. In this conversation, I speak to Georgie about believing women, she said, he said rape accusations, and the problem of undue doubt. Georgie Gardiner, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you so much for hosting. I'm thrilled to be here.
So the conversation that we're having today is all about believing women. And I think by now the whole Believe Women campaign is pretty familiar to most people, insofar as what most people understand it as some kind of, you know, an exhortation, you know, an imperative to receive accusations about sexual abuse or other abuse accusations in a particular way, you know, vis-a-vis with belief, actually believe women when they make these accusations. And in a way, I kind of saw it as a branch, you know, an offshoot of the Me Too campaign, but I think it more or less has, you know, a life of its own at this point, you know, as a movement and as a demand, and it's gained a lot of traction in recent years. At the same time, I think people still have quite a lot of questions about what it means to believe women, about what exactly this is asking us to do, and whether there are good reasons to just believe on a person's say-so, or to just believe as a default stance. And also, you know, how the demand to believe women interacts with people's ideas about what is just to the accused person. So I think there's a lot of, you know, kind of confusion that a lot of people feel about this, that they don't know quite how to articulate. And that's the reason I wanted to speak to you about it, because you have written a lot about doubt and disbelief, particularly in the context of what you call she said, he said rape accusations, and particularly about unjustified doubt and disbelief and what causes that. So I want to speak all about these things, or for you to speak about these things, but I wondered first of all if you could say a bit about she said, he said rape accusations and what defines those things.
Yeah, great, thank you so much. So I call them she said, he said rape accusations, even though the kind of the hackneyed expression, the more common expression is he said, she said, and that sort of rolls off the tongue, it's such a common expression, and we'll come back to why I change up that order. But a she said, he said accusation is a case of a rape accusation against somebody and then they deny it. And there's no other significant evidence, no other evidence that would really kind of have a mark on it, like a witness, a recording, some other kind of long string of other accusations or something like that, some other significant evidence. I say significant because there might be other evidence, but it's pretty paltry. So it might be like, and I sort of talk about why this is paltry, why this actually doesn't have so much bearing on whether we should believe the accusation, that maybe she seemed fine the next day, like she did well at school that semester, or that she was friendly to him afterwards. So it's really just the accusation and the denial with no other significant evidence and no other case-specific evidence, so evidence specifically about that case. And the reason I want to make that distinction is I think there is significant evidence that bears on these cases, but it's general evidence, like generally speaking, are accusations true? Generally speaking, how common is rape of that kind of mode, like on a college campus between people who are dating, for example? That's general evidence about the world, not about the specific case.
So can we talk about that claim, that the general evidence claim? Because you say exactly this in one of your papers, you make this claim that strikes me as quite significant, that when we have a she said, he said type accusation, so it's testimony, it's conflicting testimony, and there isn't any other evidence outside of the testimony or what you would call general evidence. You say, as a matter of probabilities, just kind of background probabilities, most likely, as soon as you have that accusation, there's reason to think that it's true. More likely than not that it's true. Even though it's one person's word against another, as people say, and there's no other kind of corroborating evidence. So I wonder, could you take us through that thinking, you know, that claim?
Sure, yeah. And so what happens in these kinds of cases, these she said, he said cases, is they're often met with like a kind of doubt, suspicion, or what's seen as a kind of, effectivism? Effectivism means you say 50-50. Either way, 50-50, we don't know what happened. And that's seen as like the wise and careful response, the cautious response. So you might say, well, there's the accusation, but where's her evidence?
Right.
And as an epistemologist, I was so struck. So epistemology is the study of evidence, knowledge, belief, reasoning, testimony, doubt. I was struck when people would say, where's her evidence? Because usually we take testimony to be evidence of the claim. We say, well, we don't have any evidence. Well, if she said it happened, usually, you know, if I say I had cereal for breakfast, that's evidence I had cereal for breakfast. So why are some people so withholding, so doubtful in these cases? So I called them she said, he said, to really emphasize that the accusation comes first. And that's really important epistemically. And calling them he said, she said kind of hides the fact that the accusation comes first. But the accusation comes first because it bears on incentives. Who has the incentive to speak? So for people who are who haven't been rape victims, like most of them, they have no incentive to speak because they have no sort of fact to deliver. And then where people are rape victims, the strong incentives are actually to not speak at all. So the incentives there are often just silence rather than speech, because the costs of accusations of speaking are so high. So it's disruptive to, you know, within families, if it's a friend of the family or an immediate family member, or it could be disruptive to one's profession or one's university environment. Because again, we're talking about acquaintance rape, not these stranger rapes where it's like, well, some rape occurred, but we don't even know who it is. If it's an accusation and denial, then they're known to each other. So accusations can be very costly. And for this reason, most acquaintance rapes are not reported.
So again, just thinking about kind of bearing on probabilities, the idea is that incentives goes to probabilities. They're just, unless you have some other understanding of what's going on or the reason to think so, there isn't a good reason for people to bring an accusation. That isn't true. Whereas there is a good reason for somebody to deny an accusation, which is true. And you think that bears on the probability question.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So the incentives are feeding into these base rates, and then also feeding into what we should make of individual cases. Base rates means general case. What tends to happen is a social statistic.
Can I ask, would things stand differently if, I suppose, say we knew something about the accuser that made it seem different? For instance, this is a person who had brought spurious accusations, you know, accusations that were later found out to be spurious in the past, for instance.
Yes, that kind of thing can then make it so that it's not merely a she said, he said case, but now has significant other evidence.
Yeah.
And those cases are relatively rare, and we can talk about what the statistics look like of false accusations, and when we have false accusations, what do they look like? Because the string of false accusations is one of the hallmarks of a false accusation. And in fact, that means if it's somebody who hasn't really made an accusation before, that's evidence that it's not one of the things that patterns after a false accusation. So it doesn't resemble a false accusation, because false accusations have a certain pattern, which I'll also sketch. So yeah, so then with the incentives for the denier, the person who's accused, their incentive actually is to usually not say anything at all, just keep it quiet. But where they do have an incentive to speak, normally it's to deny, and that's partly so they can at least retain a kind of a veneer, so their immediate family, their mum, their boss can just sort of have this plausible deniability of the veneer of carrying on with life. So, and then one can all, so there's these incentives to lie in that case. We tend to focus on incentives for the accuser to lie, but actually the denier has incentives to lie in almost every case. And they can always, of course, come clean later if necessary. So that's the incentives question. Then base rates, and this relates now too with what false accusations look like, but we have this spectre of false accusations. It looms so large in the public imagination. People bring up false accusations the possibility of false mm-hmm. accusations all the time.
Right, it has a lot of kind of prominence in the imagination, I guess.
It certainly does, and that salience, which is salience, is kind of, it comes easily to attention, it's something salient to us, mm-hmm. Is epistemically pernicious, by which I mean it's not just kind of a fact about our psychology, it actually has these effects where it's so prominent in our mind that it's what causes us to doubt, and sometimes, in fact, can even make it so that, you know, maybe people even should doubt because we have this kind of society infected by doubt. And if everybody's doubting, it's kind of like, is it irrational then to believe? And we can talk a little bit more about that, but the idea is that this widespread doubt can actually kind of be a really bad thing because it means that other people should doubt. So
but it's important in your saying this, the reason why you're saying this is because your, you know, as a kind of a, an important background premise is false accusations as a matter of fact are actually very rare, mm-hmm. in which case to be constantly thinking about the possibility of a false accusation leads us astray,
yeah.
because it doesn't reflect reality.
Right, exactly. It's like we have this kind of giant conspiracy theory that we've mm-hmm. all kind of built it, sort of bought into, and every time we bring up the specter of false accusations, we're kind of further solidifying this conspiracy theory, when actually there's this really different, powerful thing we could do, which is often just ignore the possibility because it's irrelevantly far-fetched.
Can we speak more about that? Because this idea of something being irrelevantly far-fetched comes a lot into your explanations of what you call undue doubt and disproportionate doubt. So it's kind of how our thinking patterns get manipulated such that the possibility that something isn't true, or, you know, a reason to doubt something, just gets a lot more airtime than it really should. And which isn't warranted, and you call this doubt mongering. So, you know, there are people who are doubt mongers.
Yeah.
Could you say a bit about, you know, what does doubt mongering look like then? How can a person doubt monger?
Yeah, for sure. So bringing up the specter of false accusations is one of those methods.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I would just say back to the base rates thing.
Mm.
So I went through these like large studies, a lot of them are actually in Britain, of accusations that were reported to the police, often were the ones. And there was this question where the ones that were deemed false and then the ones that were deemed true, what do those ones that were deemed false look like? And there weren't many of them. Overall, they're sort of deemed true by the police. But they tend to have a pattern, and it tends to be, most of them were things like teenagers who had missed a curfew, who needed an excuse. And so they said that it was kind of this stereotype of in a dark alley on a bed of broken glass, mm-hmm. with weapons, violence, a stranger. They were usually, almost always actually, reported by a third party, usually the parents,
right.
usually dropped within a day or two. That's when we have accusations that are false. Well, they're not even accusations, because they're not accusing any particular person, they're claims. That's what false rape claims normally look like. The other pattern that comes up is people with a string of false accusations accusing people like police wardens.
Okay.
For financial gain. So people that work for the state, work for the government. That's another pattern. So people who are, for example, in institutions like prisons, making accusations against the wardens in a string of false accusations. So those things pattern nothing like acquaintance rape claims of these she said, he said case. So if
mm-hmm.
you see an accusation like a typical she said, he said case, it really resembles nothing like what tends to be the false accusations. So I think that's worth emphasizing. But these mechanisms of doubt mongering, so there's a few. So doubt mongering is, yeah, this kind of seeding doubt, this causing people to have undue doubt or disproportionate doubt. What do I mean by disproportionate? Well, disproportionate to the total available evidence, and then disproportionate to other kinds of beliefs that we would have, like other claims, like about what I had for breakfast, or even other kinds of accusations.
Right, so the idea is most of the time when somebody just tells you something happened to them, you rely on their testimony without really thinking anything about it to form a belief that that in fact is true. But doubt mongering kind of changes this when it comes to sexual assault allegations.
Yeah, where suddenly the salience, the possibility that they are speaking falsely suddenly becomes really salient to us. It's like, well, why is that?
Mm.
So there's a few mechanisms. So one is importing legal standards of proof where they're really not warranted.
Right.
So this is kind of strikingly common, and I think it's really nicely exemplified by a student of mine who in a classroom, in advanced epistemology classrooms, are really getting into this, like, what are the costs of belief in different contexts? And they had, you know, we really spent a good bit of time looking at when is a belief, what kinds of costs are relevant that might cause it that you should be more withholding because the stakes are so high. And so it sort of came up, this is in America, so it's like, well, what if there was an accusation against somebody in your frat? These communities of sort of undergrad men.
Yeah.
And the student, very bright student, was like, well, I would withhold. I was like, oh, why is that? He's like, well, he could go to prison. I was like, but
you're not sending him to prison. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Your belief won't send him to prison. Yeah. You're not a juror. In fact, you couldn't be a juror. He's in your frat. And so this person
that's such a good answer.
He had imaginatively projected himself into
right.
the role of the juror.
Right.
And therefore had this like high stakes, but it's really not high stakes. This idea that we need to hear all the evidence or else we should have this effectic stance, this withholding, this suspension, is inevitably going to lead to doubting rape accusations.
Right. And in the case of other, again, because it's kind of comparative, right? That's really important here. When we discuss other accusations about other wrongs that people have done, we don't immediately start saying, but innocent until proven guilty. But, you know, I must reserve judgment until I see a full trial and, you know, all, more evidence coming out and this sort of thing. And it's that asymmetry that is really quite distinctive.
It is, yeah. And it's like, if I sort of would if I withheld on believing any science unless I had personally read all the evidence,
right.
I would inevitably not believe any science because I'm not going to read all the evidence. And so similarly, it's kind of like, if I'm going to withhold unless I hear all the evidence about any rape accusation, well, inevitably I'm just going to doubt them all.
Yeah. And I guess what's important here is we're talking about informal conversational contexts. So we're not talking about, you know, if you're the juror. Of course, if you're the juror, you do want to hear all the evidence, you know, mm-hmm. and you want to sift through it and be extremely analytical and not rely on, you know, probabilities and that sort of thing. But I think what's interesting here is, you know, these sort of legalistic standards, people start throwing them around in informal conversations, in contexts in which they ordinarily would never say things like that, right? That's what always strikes me about suddenly hearing something like, you know, but, you know, beyond reasonable doubt, da da da. And I'm thinking, well, hang on, when have you ever said beyond reasonable doubt? You know, if somebody came to you and said, you know, this happened to me today.
Yeah. And I think part of the mechanism causing this is we want to think. So this very point I mentioned to this very astute philosopher, brilliant, feminist. And they said, well, I think it's because the usual context is the courtroom. And I was so struck because it's really not.
The courtroom sees really very little of all of this. Yeah.
Right. Most rapes go unreported. Most victims would never kind of see their day in court. Most rape claims are actually not even accusations because the person's not named. It's just a friend saying, oh, yes, I was, you know, years ago, blah, 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 and offering very few details. Most discussion about rape from rape victims is not an accusation. They're not looking for any particular consequences for the victim. They're looking for something like emotional support mm-hmm. or bonding socially. And so then when we import this idea that this person could now go to prison unless you take it seriously, it's this kind of alchemy of thought where really most victims, when they're talking about rape, it's much more informal. They're not naming anybody, they're not identifying anybody. And yet then we have these kind of like this brilliant philosopher I just mentioned saying, well, the usual context of talking about rape accusations is a courtroom. And it's really just, that's the very rare case.
Back to the doubt mongering idea and, you know, the mechanisms, I guess, of doubt mongering, sorry. You use a really nice example in one of your papers where you talk about a bird watcher. And I just found this kind of like very illuminating where you say, well, imagine that you're a bird watcher and she sees what looks like a robin and then forms the belief, well, that must be a robin. And then you're trying to explain what doubt mongering looks like. And you say, well, somebody could come along and give her any number of possibilities, like error, what you call error possibilities, that would explain why, despite the fact that she saw what looked identical to a robin, it wasn't a robin. You know, maybe it was a chaffinch in disguise. Maybe she had been slipped some hallucinogenic drugs without her knowledge. And then people try to kind of manipulate her into doubting by really underscoring these error possibilities and saying, well, you can't eliminate them. You can't disprove that any of these things might have happened. Hence, you can't really know that you see a robin. And you give a really nice response to that.
Yeah, great. So I draw a lot on this kind of idea of called the relevant alternatives theory, which I won't go into in much detail. But the idea is if there's a claim, a belief, like that's a robin in the bush, or this person raped this person. That's the claim. And then there's a bunch of ways that that could be false. So it could be like, well, it's not a robin, it's a particularly bright chaffinch. Or it's not a robin, it's a robot.
Right. The birds conspiracy. There are no birds.
Yeah. And the idea is that some of those might be relevant, that our evidence needs to rule them out. And some of them are irrelevantly far-fetched. It's just absurd. Like, oh, yeah, you were slipped a hallucinogenic drug. Or, oh, this just is a robot robin that just looks exactly like a normal robin. And one part of this kind of this epistemology of rape accusations that I really emphasize in using this theory is that there will always be error possibilities that aren't eliminated by your evidence. Mm-hmm. That's just an inevitable fact about how evidence works. Our evidence is never fully, completely, 100% conclusive. There's always remaining error possibilities that aren't eliminated by the evidence, that aren't ruled out by the evidence. The thing is, often they're kind of irrelevantly far-fetched. So the idea of a robot robin, we just know to ignore it. We kind of learn from other people which ones we ignore and which ones we don't ignore. And we just learn to ignore certain ones. And once we really grasp that there's always error possibilities that are uneliminated, the mere fact of error possibilities that are uneliminated by our evidence is actually not a reason to doubt.
Right.
Because we have to distinguish the ones that are relevant, that we have to rule out, from the irrelevant ones. And then what happens with the rape accusations is that all gets a bit squiffy. So one example is Bill Cosby.
Mm.
I say his name wrong sometimes, Crosby or Cosby, but Bill Cosby.
I think we know who you mean.
So over 50 accusers had come forward. Over 50. I mean, the evidence was astoundingly large. And his co-star, I want to say her name, I forget her name, it might have been Phyllis O'Neill or something, was like, he tried to buy NBC. Somebody has a vested interest in him not buying NBC. So she is so motivated to believe mm-hmm. in his innocence that she kind of goes to this conspiracy theory about like keeping him down and this kind of... So we very creatively go to these kinds of conspiracy theories. And then what can happen is when you think of something like that, you have this aha moment. Aha, I've solved the puzzle.
Right.
And so you have this... what can feel really enjoyable, like solving an epistemic puzzle, like seeing how things fit together.
Right, and the puzzle is find a way in which the person is innocent that still explains all the facts that we have, right? That's the puzzle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because there will always be a way to do that, right? There's always going to be some like, well, there's a giant conspiracy or we're actually all hallucinating. Or
right, you can get more and more far-fetched
to do
that.
This kind of Descartes idea that there's an evil demon controlling the world, like The Matrix, which is an old film that maybe some of our younger viewers
won't know
the reference. But yes, there's always going to be a way of doing it. And if we think of the way, then we have this aha moment, which is quite a nice feeling and usually means that we're onto something. Usually if we have that epistemic emotion of aha,
yeah,
we're onto something. But here it's misleading. And it's misleading because we're too attached to one part of the thing that we're trying to make consistent, which is in this case, Cosby's innocence.
Right. So in having the aha moment and the nice feeling, you forget the fact that, again, as a matter of baseline probabilities, you know, sometimes the simplest explanation is more likely, you know, the correct one. It's still more likely than not that these women, many women accusing him across a long time span, are simply telling the truth, as opposed to, you know, this very elaborate counter-explanation being true. It's like, yes, you came up with a brilliant counter-explanation. Now think about the likelihoods.
Yeah, and part of this is like the emotions of attachment, the emotions of not wanting our worldview upset. And part of it is that we overestimate how weird acquaintance rape is. Mm. So we think of it as far-fetched that one of our friends would have raped somebody. It's not far-fetched at all. But taking that on board is really disruptive to our lives. And so the disruptiveness of believing the prevalence of rape and then any specific rape accusation. And so we can have these kinds of, again, these epistemic mechanisms where every sort of mode of acquaintance rape, way of acquaintance rape, might seem far-fetched, like somebody has the freeze response, mm-hmm. or remains asleep during penetration, or sort of that somebody who seems like a nice guy actually used force. They seem so far-fetched to so many people, but they happen all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have these other kinds of examples, especially during the Me Too movement, where people would post on Facebook these, you know, beautiful testimonials where they would say things like, well, I believed that I would fight back. I was confident I would fight back until it happened to me. Somebody else underneath the same thing, like, and so we kind of have a lot of false beliefs, a lot of myths about what how we think rape works, how we think acquaintance rape works, both who is committing rape and how a victim's responding. With rape, there's a lot of mistakes about that. So that's part of what's also fueling this doubt, mm-hmm. is that acquaintance rape seems implausible, but it's really
until
not.
You know a bit more, yeah. I mean, so we're doing a lot of, we're kind of piling on doubt. This is kind of a doubt pile on, yeah. And piling on doubt mongering. But I do also want to say a bit more and talk a bit more about it by way of understanding doubt and where doubt comes from. And maybe question whether there may be doubt that is legitimate for some reasons or in certain contexts. So, for instance, you know, we mentioned the presumption of innocence before. And, of course, in law, there is a presumption of innocence. And one of the mistakes people make is that, you know, they import this presumption of innocence into conversational context as if we're in a courtroom, we said. And they're not. And there are standards of evidence that you have to prove depending on what kind of court case it is. But somebody might say, OK, well, in social life, it's not that there are no consequences for an accused person of general belief in his guilt. In fact, there can be quite profound consequences if people typically, you know, people on the whole, believe on the strength of an accusation, especially a rape accusation, that this person is guilty. And I do think that's where a lot of the anxiety comes from, especially when we're then thinking about forming a belief in guilt on the basis of probabilities. You know, generally speaking, accusations are true. Generally speaking, you know, we shouldn't doubt. And yet, we see what it can mean for the accused person, that belief is just kind of quite easily given in these contexts. So I wonder what you think about that. You know, should there be any form of a presumption of innocence in social life?
Mm. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I think this is another case where we're somewhat mistaken about the reality, because I think we overestimate the costs, mm-hmm. of both our own individual beliefs, which I talked a bit about, but including just in informal contexts. And then also even in some institutional cases, we tend to think of it as it so readily springs to mind the college athlete who's had their career ruined, or the person who's now unemployed, or and actually those kinds of costs, those kinds of consequences are actually quite rare. So when we think about, so there's a scholar, Nicole Badera. She did her PhD at Michigan, and she looked at specifically these cases in American institutions. These are called Title IX cases.
Yeah.
And her work suggests that actually these, when people are accused, it's not particularly bad for them. And in fact, it can be quite positive because they end up talking a lot to the deans and things like that. So that's her sociology work, which I don't want to talk too much about, but that's kind of one context where she's talking about how that we overestimate the costs. But also when we think about our individual lives, I think we tend to think we would have these, you know, we would lose a friend and this person would get fired. And that's because we have this just world hypothesis, this just world fallacy, where we think of the world as a certain way, where if somebody committed a rape, so if we believe mm-hmm. that they're guilty of this, then there
things
would all be all kinds of consequences.
Yeah.
Often not much happens, mm-hmm. really.
So you're saying actually, we overestimate, you know, the stakes of belief, especially social belief. When we're again deciding what should I believe, these sorts of consequences don't depend on what I believe. But also, I'm kind of interested in maybe the more institutional type consequences where they do. So, if we are thinking of, you know, disciplinary hearings, you know, expulsions from college, if it does come to that, and I completely take your point that most often it doesn't, or even, you know, kind of something which I think is maybe, you know, not entirely rare, which is just boycotting, you know, informal boycotting, right? Mm. You know, there's an accusation, The accusations become quite public, quite prominent. All of a sudden, somebody is not invited to conferences anymore. They're not invited to anything anymore. Their life isn't over, right? That would be a gross overestimation. They still have their friends, they still have their family, still, but there's a kind of a professional social boycotting response. So in that way, maybe perhaps not individual belief, but general belief has consequences. I wonder what you think kind of evidence standards should be for things like this.
Yeah, great, great. So in these cases where there's maybe a disciplinary, in, for example, a college or an employment situation, I think these can be kind of tricky because, like I've emphasized, that in these she said, he said cases, probably the accusation is true. And where there's a denial, probably it's false. And to ignore that is to commit the base, and to not believe that is to commit the base rate fallacy of ignoring the base rates. Mm-hmm. And then it gets a bit tricky because sort of like, well, now what if this is an institutional context? And so in the US under Obama, we have these things called Title IX proceedings, and that's where there's this formal accusation of sexual misconduct is then goes through this hearing. And again, a lot of accusations sort of don't get to the hearing stage, but if they do get to the hearing stage, that's the Title IX proceedings. And Obama mandated that they're governed by what's called the preponderance of the evidence standard, which roughly speaking means, well, we call it balance of evidence in the UK, more likely than not, which a lot of people understand is like
51%.
You know, yeah, right. Yeah. And so that the Obama administration mandated that. And I think this is really interesting because in she said, he said cases, just the accusation and the denial will, I argue, exceed that. But in that case, it's just an accusation and a denial with, and by definition, no other significant case-specific evidence.
When you
evidence.
Say exceed, you mean just the accusation and denial meets that threshold, preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not true. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And so that's a little bit uncomfortable because that means that somebody could be fired or suspended or expelled just on one person's say-so. And I want to really clearly distinguish this from other cases where, like, there's a string of accusations or something, because that's not a she said, he said case.
Yes.
And where you do have things like boycotts, usually it's
something like that.
A string of different accusers. But where it could, you know, in sometimes in these Title IX cases, and I think she said, he said cases are more rare than they sort of loom large in the public imagination, but actually quite rare. Usually there's other evidence. But I think this is a bit uncomfortable because it's important to be living in a kind of liberal society where we can't simply be fired because of one person's say-so, especially because of the nature of testimonial evidence, where, for example, if we distinguish between easy to fake and hard to fake. Mm-hmm. Now, this is different from is it likely to be true, right? Because I argue at length that accusations are probably true, they're usually true, there's very few incentives to lie. But now we can look at some other epistemic questions about it, like is it easy to fake? And so some kinds of evidence are really hard to fake, like a video evidence, very hard to fake. But testimony, I mean, especially one with kind of acting skills, one can say all sorts of things.
Right.
And I kind of argue that in these, if accusations and are so likely to be true that they would, that in these, she said, in these accusations and denials, probably the accusation is true, then actually in theory, you could just have a written accusation, a written denial, not look at anything else and fire the person.
Well, precisely, yeah.
If the preponderance of the evidence is a standard. And that's weird. That's really weird. That kind of evidence would satisfy at least that legal standard of proof of preponderance of the evidence. And so I think we have this real tension between some things that we want to kind of hold dear. These tensions between the epistemic claim that I argue for, which is that accusations or tend to be true, and it doesn't have to be that they're always true, right? I'm not saying 100%, just above 50%, right? That's easily met. And then sort of feminist claims that if somebody's found guilty of something like rape on campus, then that warrants considerable consequences, like being fired or expelled or suspended. And then these kind of liberal claims that we don't want to sort of fire people just based on one person's say-so without some other kind of evidence.
So it seems important to me there that you're saying, yes, it is still nevertheless true that if something is a she said, he said case, conflicting testimony, that's all we have, it's still more likely than not that it's true. Despite that, there's something problematic, maybe for other reasons, about allowing that evidence alone, even though it grounds belief, you know, it's a good reason for belief, to redound in those kinds of consequences. Because it's still the case that it's one person say so. It's still probably true, but it's very little on which to pin such massive consequences.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because it's like, it's a little and it's a lot.
It's a little and it's a lot because it's still, because it's enough to ground the preponderance claim. Yeah.
So epistemically, it's a lot. But evidence has lots of different properties. And so whether it makes it probably true is one property, but then there are these other kinds of properties that maybe have important moral and social import. Like, can it could it easily be faked if somebody tried? Could be politically really important or morally really important because we want to kind of live in a certain kind of society. Mm-hmm. And then there's other social kinds of reasons that are things like, well, when people are sort of victims of false accusations, who tends to be the victims there? And it tends to be, for example, gay men who have had sex with somebody who kind of, somebody who has a kind of internalized homophobia and so then later denies it. Or it tends to be black people, for example. In this American college context, black athletes.
Right.
So it's kind of these questions, these political questions about who are we protecting as well can kind of come into play there.
We've been speaking about fakery, and kind of concerns that people have about faked testimony. And I suppose that, you know, the common phrase that we have used and that other people use is false rape accusations. And a huge amount of doubt mongering, as we've said, tries to amplify the possibility outside of what is realistic that the accusation is dishonest, you know, that somebody is just outright lying. But I'm actually quite interested in a different kind of a doubt. I wonder whether some of the time when people raise doubts, they're actually not thinking about the possibility of a false rape accusation, you know, kind of a knowingly dishonest accusation, but something more like a kind of an incorrect or a mistaken accusation, so that the doubtful thought that they are forming is not she's lying or she's lying for financial gain, but is something more like, I'm not sure what she would call rape is what I would call rape or sexual assault or whatever else it is. Mm-hmm. And this strikes me as something a bit different, mm-hmm. Maybe problematic in all sorts of ways, but with a very different character, because it's more kind of evaluative, right? It's doubt about judgments that we are all making and whether we're making the same judgments. Mm. And it's also, it also ties into kind of maybe deep-seated disagreements about what counts as what. So that before you've heard details, and I think it's important, maybe when you've heard details, this changes things. But before you've heard details, if you just know there is an accusation, it is an accusation of sexual assault, there are all these questions that people might have, which is like, well, what exactly happened? And I think this is why people are interested in details, mm. because deep down they might not want to say it, but they're wondering whether what happened is what they would call an assault.
Yeah, these questions of, like, among other things, these questions of categorization.
Yes.
Yeah, and my brilliant student actually just wrote a PhD dissertation on exactly this question, on about specifically rape accusations and when people kind of agree about some of the basic facts but then disagree about
the characterization. That's what I'm really interested in, because it doesn't suggest that anyone is lying, which I think is what you're saying, is this is often the far-fetched, the irrelevantly far-fetched possibility that doesn't need to be excluded. You know, maybe they're lying, maybe it's a mass conspiracy. This is something that strikes me as, but it's not far-fetched. We know we disagree about these things. Mm. I disagree about these things with my colleagues a lot of the time. I wonder if that makes for a proportion of the doubt?
Yeah, yeah, good. So it's kind of funny, right? Because if people have different conceptions of something like rape, then of course, you know, one might be mistaken oneself. So have a too narrow conception.
Sure, you should
count it as rape. So there's a few, yeah. So I right at the beginning when we were talking about why I think rape accusations are true, I mentioned incentives, base rates, and then evidence. And in a way, we're kind of circling back to evidence. Like, if somebody's mistaken, who's mistaken and why?
Mm-hmm.
And so people who are victims are often mistaken, but they're mistaken in the false negative way, not the false positive way. So what the first major book about rape accusations was called I Never Called It Rape,
mm-hmm.
because it was something like 73% of victims didn't categorize it as rape despite having excellent evidence that it counted. And so this is this question of categorization. But notice that's the kind of wrong direction to be relevant, right? Because this is cases where people are miscategorizing it, but they're miscategorizing something that was rape
as not rape.
Mm-hmm. Whereas this other question is, what about people who characterize something as rape when it actually wasn't? And I think it's worth noting that actually people who deny, so rape, people who are kind of committing rape, they might be more incentivized to do that, to sort of self-protective hermeneutical blocks.
Sure.
Or in fact, they committed rape partly because they didn't realize that it was counting as rape. So where we have these miscategorizations, both it could be me, the doubter, with a too narrow conception of what counts as rape. It is one, but I'm thinking it isn't. And it could be also be that the perpetrator isn't counting it as rape when it is, and that's causing the denial. But yeah, and I suppose then there are these cases about somebody who maybe they're the person who thinks of themselves as a victim, and they're simply wrong. Perhaps they were sort of perhaps very drunk, and they consented to sex with somebody, and they woke up the next morning thinking, well, of course I couldn't have done that, so thinking that they were raped but falsely, maybe because of something like that it was homosexual sex and they couldn't think of themselves as ever consenting to that, or because it was they thought of themselves as too drunk to consent, but maybe that's, you know, more like something they were telling themselves, partly to kind of protect their own self-conception as somebody who doesn't have one-night stands, or somebody who doesn't think of themselves as somebody who would, you know, they have an internalized racism or something like that. Or they had a, you know, it was actually, they just couldn't imagine that they consented because it would have been cheating maritally or something. I think these cases are probably fairly rare, but I think, you know, it's worth mentioning. And I think what's much more common is this other kind of playing around with conceptions, this playing around with which labels fit. And there can be really real value in that. This kind of, I have another project about the value of self-deception about rape victims who hide it from themselves. It sounds so funny for
the value of it.
Yeah, why it can be a good kind of ignorance. Which is so funny for an epistemologist, because we're normally like, follow the
truth.
Follow the evidence. Knowledge is good. Belief is good. You know, and in this case, I argue that there are cases where rape victims hiding it from themselves, having this self-deception, can actually be really valuable. Partly it lets them get on with their life. And that project is called Unthinkable. And I talk in that about how that experimentally trying on different labels, he took advantage of me and things like this.
Right.
Something funny happened. Can actually kind of have a cognitive value of kind of this experimental thing. Now, the problem is, in institutional or legal settings where it's formal, we need clarity. We need our words to be pretty hard and fixed. But this is kind of maybe less important in these social, emotional, psychological cases where playing around with labels can be this kind of helpful experimental process. And then there's this kind of clash between them where the playing around with labels, if we're thinking of it as a legal case, it suddenly really matters. We need to be very cautious. But actually, if what's really going on, what's really important is the emotions of the person, you know, where there was something bad happened and they're sort of figuring out the label, then it can be okay to experimentally try on these different labels.
This is moving on to something different, but I'm also interested in occasions when kind of purported disbelief is actually inauthentic and is masking some kind of a different objection to an accusation and what's going on, which maybe for good reason the doubter doesn't want to be forthcoming about. So cases where people might say she's not telling the truth, but if you think about it, it just seems implausible that they don't really believe the accusation. And so I wonder if this is kind of case where the anger and the objection is about something totally different, but for kind of interesting psychological reasons, it gets kind of spun out into just straightforward disbelief. You know, she's just not telling the truth.
Mm. Yeah, this idea of like the kind of, if it's not the perfect victim, it's not a victim at all. So if the person seems to have deserved something or other because they are sort of in prison or something like this, or they also were also abusing the other person in that kind of thing. So in her book, Credible, Deborah Turkheimer discusses this kind of motivation, where it's something like there's the belief question, the evidence question, and then there's the question about desert or what's warranted, or how much do we want to destabilize the world as well. So I think sometimes people are motivated to sort of claim doubt or to overemphasize the potential for doubt because they don't want the destabilizing force of belief in their lives. Mm. So wives, for example, with respect to an accusation against the husband, it would just be such an upheaval for the accusation to be true, and so they sort of socially claim it's a false accusation, even though in reality they do basically believe mm-hmm. the accusation. Mm-hmm. They just sort of don't want to. I think there's a kind of admitting it to oneself, and then the saying it out loud kind of can solidify a claim in one's mind. And I think also with rape victims too, when they say something to somebody else, it ossifies it, yes. which is turns it to stone. It makes it concrete.
Said it now, it's out. Mm-hmm, yeah.
This is the label. Whereas if it's just kind of playing with the ideas in your mind, they can be a lot more malleable, a lot more kind of hard to grab. You can't grab them. It's sort of, you don't have to apply a label if you're just thinking it through in your mind. You can just sort of think through in a much more mushy kind of way. So I think that's a big part of what's going on too, is keeping it mushy in the mind.
Yeah, I understand that. I mean, I wonder if the Brett Kavanaugh case was, for some people, you know, for some, the disbelief that was being voiced, another example of this, in that, you know, I mean, I even had conversations with people in which at one point they seem to be saying, it's just not credible. You know, why is this person making this accusation now? It's politically motivated, et cetera, et cetera. And after we'd gone through all the reasons why it is credible, finally we got to, but something like this that happened years ago shouldn't derail this person's life. You know, it's just not serious enough. And then you realize, okay, so that's what's really going on. That's what's really motivating. So why has it ended up being presented as a belief about, as an objection about truth and credibility, when it was really an objection about dessert?
Yeah, great. And this actually kind of calls to mind the kind of Stanford swimmer example mm-hmm. of the father's claim, why should his, you know, life be ruined or whatever, for 20 minutes of action. Mm. So similar. And I think this relates back to that just world hypothesis thing, where we want to believe that these big consequences, we believe, so we want to believe of ourselves, so of course we're committed to big consequences, we're committed to not being friends with the person anymore, we're committed to this, of course people who are guilty would go to prison, we wouldn't hang out with them anymore, we would fire them, they would get fired, whatever the claims are. And so we don't act, that's not actually true, and so we say it's a lack of belief, yeah. so that we can continue thinking, you know, were I to believe it, then I would blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And we wouldn't.
As opposed to maybe kind of confronting the dessert question a bit more head on, right? If people have anxieties, genuine anxieties about what is proportionate in response to what, maybe that's the conversation that we should be having.
Yeah. And another huge role, a huge factor here is attention. Mm. Like the role of attention. What do we pay attention to when sort of both in the media, what kinds of claims and cases get airtime, so the kind of the Duke LaCrosse case, a false accusation, gets a lot of airtime. And then in our own minds, when we're thinking about a person, what springs to mind, what kinds of things do we more readily forget? And so there's the question of what do we believe, and then belief can only really play big cognitive roles if you act on it, think about it rather than ignore it, sort of make other inferences from it, and sort of be inclined to remember it rather than forget it and bring it up to other people. And so rape accusations can also play this kind of, when they are in fact believed, they can, the cognitive role that they play can be downplayed through these kinds of other mechanisms like attention mm-hmm. and not connecting up all the other dots.
So again, that kind of lowers the stakes of belief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like we kind of partition the belief off. It gets kind of put into a little box and doesn't really infuse the rest of our thoughts in quite that way. And this might also partly be because there's something a little bit mind-boggling about how serious rape is and how common it is. Like, this is genuinely very challenging to grasp.
Yes.
And it's this kind of banality of, it's kind of banality of evil. Like,
yes.
How, like, the sort of Hannah Arendt, like, how evil happens, and yet it's so bad. And so I have this, I'm editing a book called The Philosophy of Sexual Violence, and one of the papers in it, it's really fantastic, I think it's called The Banality of Rape, and it really wrestles with this question about how it's so common and so bad,
right?
And really how to grasp that cognitively.
Well, thank you so much for this, Georgie Gardner.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about these topics. It's not the most fun to talk about, but I'm really grateful for the opportunity.